right?
All right, let's get started. I had one thing I wanted to add about 4 and 5, and I'm going to get the microphone to Sandy to start us out with 6. My experience is today that when we talked about orthodoxy, there is more attention on form today than I think there has ever been before. And some of the guys that I see going through and doing a fifth step, they keep reusing the same words over and over and over again. It becomes mechanical. And you don't get a sense, and I think technically, if you follow too rigidly the format that is in the book, there are certain issues that, of course, it has to do with the attitude of a person bringing in. So if they have a gambling issue, if they have something that isn't technically covered under resentment or fear or sex, sometimes there can be some fairly significant things that the person either will intentionally or mistakenly just not include in the process of doing the steps. And I don't think the form of the form is not intended in any way to impede a full communication of yourself and what you need to communicate to make that, to complete a good fifth step, regardless of the, so don't let the format and attention to the form diminish the substance of what you're about in that communication. To be fully communicated is where the opening and grace comes in.
Thanks, Bob.
Before I get on 6, there was a couple of things that I just of a more general nature. One of them is, this is just a little thought. For those of you that are relatively new.
You don't have any little thoughts.
Oh, all right. And that is, imagine that you went back in time and you live somewhere where there's only one meeting a week. And you're going to stay sober on one meeting a week. Did you ever think about what it would be like to try and stay sober on one meeting a week? Well, number one, you'd really look forward to the meeting. Wow, 3 more days, got the meeting. Yeah, boy, that's going to be fun. It'll be a big deal. So then you might meet some other guy or gal who's in the group, and halfway through the week, you'd meet for coffee to break up the week. And then you could sit and talk about there. And then you could read some of the literature. Mostly, you prayed like hell. That's how you got through when there's one meeting a week. You just prayed like hell to get there. So now we come to today. I'm just comparing the two situations. We got 6 a.m. meetings, 10 a.m. meetings, noon meetings, 5:45 meetings, midnight meetings, men's meetings, women's meetings, tall people's meetings. We got conventions. We got retreats. We got such a huge support system. You don't have to hardly pray at all. You see what I'm saying? We can rely, and without realizing it, we're relying on all kinds of things other than prayer and God. And then we wonder why we're not making spiritual progress. Well, I'm in a jail meeting every Saturday. Yeah, boy, I look forward to that. I'm there. And I'm here. Now I'm there. And so we're totally being supported by something other than prayer. And it's good, but that's not the place to have our dependence on activity, action. It says nothing ensures immunity from drinking like working with another alcoholic. It doesn't say anything about spiritual growth. You see what I'm saying? That is a very personal thing, and that's something that when we get to step 11 in particular, Bill talks about this is an individual adventure, whether you're going to become a seeker. The other thing was that as the years have gone by, I find that I don't sponsor the same as I used to, because we progress and you intuitively have some other ideas. And I think about 5 years ago, I could tell this one guy I was working with, he was very resistant to the fourth and fifth step. This was too big a deal. And so I said, well, hey, just do this for me. Can you think of a couple of resentments? Oh, yeah. A real big one? Yeah, yeah. All right, well, next week, write them down, just the way it's laid out in the big book, right? These two resentments down, bring them back, and let's look at it. Well, writing down two resentments was very doable. You know what I mean? There was no more resisting and I can't get this done and all that. So he came back with the two resentments and we went through them right across the whole thing. How to affect his self-esteem, what was your part in it, et cetera, et cetera. So then I just said, well, next week, just finish the resentments and we'll just keep doing this. And he got them all done. I'm just finding ways of making people willing to do it. And then I said, okay, now I'll just write down two fears and come back next week. He didn't realize it, but he was doing his fourth and fifth step at the same time. And I didn't have to sit for 7 hours and listen to some. And when you're old, you can't keep your attention going for 7 hours. So now that's how I sponsor everybody. So anyway, that's just neither here nor there. When we get to the sixth and seventh step, this is, I think, they're some of the most important steps in the program. And of course, we see a great difference between the big book and the 12 and 12. I think Bill, you know, 12 or 15 years later, started looking at that going, wow, there's a lot more to it than just two sentences saying, are you willing? And say this little prayer, and now you're done, get on your way. And while I'm talking about prayers, just to show you, Bill really was worried that AA would get dogmatic, and he was really worried that the big book would become biblical. He just didn't want to do that. So you see, he says, suggested this and that. And in both the prayers, it says, we may say something like this, trying to discourage us from finding, oh, these words are sacred now. So if you technically wanted to comply with the third step prayer, you would make up something and say that, because that's what we're instructed to do. Do you follow what I'm saying? I'm just trying to break the dogma thing. And then the seventh step prayer, later on, he says, you may, of course, choose your own words. Trying to show the flexibility that's built into spiritual principles, that they're very flexible. And if you had two people, let's say you got two men or women, they've been around quite a while, and they're going to study the big book on how to correctly sponsor someone. And they both have identical newcomers who are totally nervous wrecks. They're so anxiety-ridden, it looks like they might drink at any time. And the first sponsor says, the way I interpret the big book is, I should postpone talking about God until we get this guy physically more calmed down. And you could say, yeah, that's right. He is interpreting that right. The second guy said, this guy needs God right now. Get on your knees and we're going to talk about God. Two identical situations, two totally opposed solutions. And so you can see that there's no such thing as the right way to do anything. Now, that's very frustrating to those of us that want black and white answers. I want to know exactly when. You know where it says sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly? How long is slowly? I want to know. When, in my case, will it happen that this... So anyway, that's enough of that. So let's get over to step six. And of course, Bill in the 12 and 12 said, this is the one that separates the men from the boys, the women from the girls. Why? Why would that little thing, we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of care, why would that be the one that is labeled, this separates the real winners from the semi-winners. There's something very big that happens here. I would say in this step, you dial in how much spiritual happiness you want is in that step right there. And when you study this step, it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. If somebody had all their character defects removed, they would be perfect. Did you ever look at that step as perfection? We don't want to hear that word. No. That's why we didn't adopt the four absolutes. We don't want to think in terms of perfection. Look at the big book, progress, not perfection. So we're being protected from perfection. And Bill said in letters that he was persuaded not to put the absolutes in because when alcoholics are new and they'd be driving themselves crazy trying to be perfectly honest or perfectly pure, and they wouldn't be able to do it, and then they'd end up getting drunk. And he said, but I snuck them back in the sixth step in the 12 and 12. I snuck it back in. What did he sneak back in? Perfection. In that middle of that sixth step, he says we have to raise our eyes towards perfection, knowing that we'll never get there. And so then he says, and I love the way he uses this word. He talks about we were able to become entirely willing to have God remove our drink problem. And he proceeded to do exactly that. Having been granted a perfect release from alcoholism, why can't we do it on all our other character defects? And now we're getting to the heart of the sixth step. We were given absolute proof that if you can be 100% willing, it'll be gone. So the rest of them aren't there because they're standing in the way of my being useful to others, as is some way of interpreting that prayer. The reason I'm still a jerk is I'm able to help people and remain a jerk. You see, that's not... The reason they're still there is I don't want them gone. I enjoy some of my character defects. They give me a lot of fun. So I would like part of them removed. And Bill writes, I don't want to be so lustful that I rape, but I don't want to be zero lust. What the hell would that be? Dead? You know, that's such an extreme. And I don't want to get rid of all greed because then I might not take care of myself. And I don't want to be totally honest because then I'd have to say things that could hurt my business deal. When they ask me, could you explain this mortgage a little more in detail? Oh, no, it's fine. You're quiet. Don't worry about it. If I actually was totally honest, I might not make the sale. So what I want is a reputation for being honest. I don't want to be, you know, trapped into actually being honest. I just want you to think you're dealing with an honest person. And then in my judgment, there are times when total honesty just doesn't apply. So you can see the game that's being played in our minds as we look at step six, which says we're entirely willing to have God remove all of our defects of character. And then we say, you know, I didn't come here to become a saint. I just came here to get sober. And look what you just said to yourself. I didn't come here to really get close to God. I'm willing to settle for something in the middle. And guess what you get? Something in the middle. You get pretty good sobriety. you've ever walked around town, you know that I've got pretty good sobriety. You could have pretty good sobriety for 25 years. How's it going? Pretty good. How are you doing? I'm doing pretty good too. We got a whole room full of people that are doing pretty good. That's actually pretty good, isn't it? And what does Bill say about that? And he quotes Lincoln, "The good is the biggest enemy of the best that there is." As long as it's good, pretty good, you're not going to do anything about it. And then you're going to wonder why you're still the same pretty good spiritual person you were 15 years ago. Because circumstances didn't drive me to make any more progress, which we'll get to in humility. And so I was willing to settle, I'm quoting Bill out of the 12 and 12, for as much perfection as will get me by. Does that make sense? Did we all do that? And so then, now I'm going to look at this, and I'm going, how can I summon the willingness to move on? And there's a great story that C.S. Lewis used to illustrate this point. And I've used it before, so if you've heard it, I apologize. But it involved a little boy with a toothache. And he's on the baseball team, and they have the big game tomorrow. And the coach said, "No more practice for you kids. All I want you to do is have a good meal and get 8 hours sleep. That's the secret. You got to get to bed in time to get 8 hours sleep. The rest will take care of itself." So he followed all this. The mother fed him, and he got to bed and this and that. And he's asleep about 3 hours, and he wakes up, and he's got a tiny toothache starting. Just, and he knows if he calls his mother, she'll give him a couple of aspirin. It'll knock out the pain. He'll be right back to sleep, and he'll be very close to getting a good night's sleep. But he doesn't call his mother. He decides instead to wait and see if it goes away by itself. And another half hour, it's a little stronger. Well, maybe I should call my, no, I think I'll wait and see if it goes away by itself. And he waits and waits until it's 2 a.m. Now he's not going to get much sleep. He calls his mother. She gives him the two aspirin. Makes him feel better. He goes back to sleep, but he doesn't play that well the next day because he's tired. And so the question, well, why'd he screw around like that? Why'd he wait? The answer is that he knew his mother, and he knew that she wouldn't stop with just giving him two aspirin. She would make a dental appointment to see what was really wrong in that tooth. And he also knew the dentist, and he knew that the dentist doesn't stop with just that tooth when you get there. The dentist gives you a full exam of all the teeth in your head, and his mother and the dentist schedule appointments until he has perfect teeth. He didn't want perfect teeth. He wanted two aspirin. But the only way he could get two aspirin was to get perfect teeth. And the help we get from God is perfect help, which is more than we really want. We would like a little help. I would like to be a little less lustful than I am. I would like to be a little less greedy. I would like to tone down. Matter of fact, let's get the seven deadly sins out, and I'll go over them. Yeah, okay, put me down for 60% reduction in lust. I'm going big. That's a big problem of mine. Now put me down for a 60% reduction in lust. I'd be willing almost to have 90% of greed removed. That's not a big deal with me. And we just start through them all. Of course, pride, it's just very difficult to get rid of that. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the difficulty of moving beyond pretty good. Do you see what I'm saying? It's in order to move beyond, see, we got to pretty good. A lot of that was done on our own with meetings and with our sponsor helping us and this and that, and God was involved totally with the alcohol. And we feel that we're praying and we like being around God and all that, but we don't want him to go too far. That's the one thing. But God wants me to keep moving. He's not happy that I'm with my where I am. There's a prayer in the 24-hour day book that said, I pray I may never be satisfied with my spiritual condition. Doesn't that sound like a strange thing to pray for? I pray that I'm eternally frustrated with where I am spiritually. So that something will keep pushing me. Something will keep pushing me to get closer. I won't stop. And so this is the situation we find ourselves in as we approach the sixth step and the rest of our sobriety in AA, is that how long are you going to stay at pretty good? And that's up to you. Do you follow what I'm saying? This is your, maybe we can start livening up our spiritual life. Maybe we can really challenge ourselves. Maybe we can start getting some books and reading about spirituality. Maybe we can start making getting closer to God a high priority, way up there on the list. And maybe we won't. But either way, we are going to experience the results of our decision. We're going to continue to have pretty good sobriety, or we're going to be trying to go beyond that. And one of the important things to understand about character defects and spirituality is you cannot improve spiritually on your own. Now, you may say, well, I would like to refute that. I was told that one of my character defects was swearing, and that it embarrassed women at the meetings, and I thought about it. I decided not to swear anymore, and I haven't said a swear word at a meeting in 3 years. So I feel that I have improved spiritually on my own. So there, take that. I said, really, you stopped swearing all by yourself? What do you think that did to your pride? Did it increase it or decrease it? I think it shot way up. Hey, man, I don't need God to get spiritual. I can accomplish this stuff on my own. That's a bad spot to be in. Because if I can accomplish that on my own, maybe I can stay sober on my own. Maybe there's a lot of things I can do on my own now that spirituality has improved my condition considerably. Matter of fact, as I sit taking stock of myself, I am no longer the desperate newcomer that when I came in. I'm much stronger than I used to be. Spirituality and God have placed me in a much stronger position where I just am so grateful that God put me where I just don't need him much anymore. Do you see the game that's being played? And it happens in all our minds. I'm not as desperate as the day I came in. Really? You really believe that? You mean so we could pull the whole thing away? The support system, the program, all of this, and you'd just go right on? Yeah, I think I could. I think I could. So this is what we're talking about. Is how can you start trying to move yourself beyond where you are? And can you make this a new priority? This, as Bill writes, this step goes on for our lifetime. And I really believe that if it was possible to get 99% of the way of being character defect free, the frustration over still having the 1% would feel just like you feel now. Do you follow what I'm saying? Because there's something inside of us that isn't going to be satisfied until God and us are one. And thank God that's there, or none of us would ever try. Bob, jump up here. Rescue me.
rescue you. Shame on you. I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. So 6 and 7 were dealt with very, very differently in the 12 and 12 than in the big book. I also think you can see a little bit of dowling in Bill's treatment. The Jesuits kind of getting their finger in the pie. For most of us, we make enormous progress in the first couple of years of our sobriety. We come in here with really significant problems, and our lives are catastrophes and a mess. And we have a surrender experience. We get into Alcoholics Anonymous. We start to get some advice. We start to take the steps. And the progress that many people make in the first couple of years is just astounding. It is just extraordinary. And you can see men and women coming in that are just beaten down. Women, I see the change sometimes more dramatically. They just look like they're no one's home. And all of a sudden, 3 or 6 months later, they come in. There's an energy, a spirit, a vibrousness. There's a presence that wasn't there before. I mean, it's almost, as Silkworth talks about, I know I recognize the person, but it's almost as if I didn't recognize the person. My experience was, and I don't know if it was exacerbated by the fact that I was so young, that then I plateaued out. And I made a lot of significant progress early in sobriety. I had a list of defects of character that I, couldn't get up early. I kept oversleeping. I later found out that it had something to do with when I went to bed. I did not know that at the time. So I had trouble getting to work, trouble staying at work, trouble working at work. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made in 1967. A lot of money. I had a gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day. I mean, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal. But I was making $5,000 a year playing backgammon. It was like my second job. I was physical and inappropriate with our first two boys. Not proud of that. But I was angry, impatient, and sometimes violent with my children. What else? There just wasn't an area of my life that I wasn't leaking in. I'm covering it up. I'm telling my sponsor most of what's going on. And I said, this is a story of my life. I'm troubled by, none of those things I just told you made my first inventory. None of them made my first inventory. Okay, they bother me the first 2 or 3 years. I'm working on them. In my fourth and fifth year, they're really eating my lunch. And it's my seventh year, I'm in trouble. Okay, and I'm saying this is the way my life's always gone. I interview well, I just don't work well. I start out well, I just don't finish. I don't finish anything. And here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody's patting me on the head, telling me what, I'm the youngest guy in the group for 2 years, telling me what a great job I'm doing. And I'm dying. I told you I tore the wall down, made a discovery I wasn't unique. I built the wall back up in AA. Thanks for helping me with my drinking problem. Stay out of my sex life. Stay out of my finances. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my parenting. Stay out of my work. Stay out of... Brick by brick, I built the damn wall back up, going to 5 meetings a week. I'm isolated. I'm alone. I feel different. I'm in trouble. I'm thinking, if I got to go to a meeting for every problem I have, I mean, I'm having enough time doing what I'm doing in AA. If I have to go to SA, GA, anger, or not, I mean, what's going on? And two things that have saved my butt in AA is I can't keep my mouth shut, so I'm talking about most of what's going on in my life, not all of it, but enough. And I love the old timers, and I had examples. I just can't tell you that. I mean, I was just attracted to the people who had good programs. And I got the sense it was like listening to Sandy. I mean, it had to do with, what did God have to do with Wednesday? And but I got a problem. If I go to God and get entirely ready to have God remove my defect of character, I mean, I've been trying to remove him for 7 years. What the hell's the use? I mean, what do you think God's going to want me to do? Quit gambling. Okay, get up in the morning, go to work, stay at work, work at work. Get on a budget, which I think is an Al-Anon word. It's not in the big book. Be kind and loving to your wife and children. I'm going to say, hell, if I could do all those things, I wouldn't need God. So I'm saying, what the hell is the use of going to God when he's going to ask me to clean my act up, and I can't do it? I've been busting my britches to try to clean my act up for 7 years. As soon as I get my act cleaned up, or maybe just mostly cleaned up, I'll develop a relationship. But the trouble I've had in my life is I keep trying to develop a relationship while I got all this crap around, and I don't think that works. And I was stuck in that place for 3 or 4 years. And out of desperation, at 7 years, I went back for my third formal time through the steps. Powerless and unmanageable? You bet. Came to believe that a power greater than myself, I had lost step two. Wonder why the hell I was in trouble? I'd lost step two. I believed it for you. I didn't believe it for me. Because I'm 7 years sober and my pants are on fire. I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I'm sponsoring people. I'm doing the deal. And I'm going backwards. I'm on the down escalator going up. I'm dying. And I guess when you're in trouble, I was allowed the privilege to start to see people with bigger problems than me walking through walls that I was trying to avoid with smiles on their faces and dignity, and I came to believe that God would restore Bob to sanity. I took step three with my sponsor on my knees in his office. I hadn't done that before, did it? Did the best fourth step I think I've ever done. I did my first fifth step with my sponsor, did the previous two with clergy, which was the way we were brought up. And I said to him, I said, when I'm done, be careful, because whatever you recommend I'm going to do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, I could pass the test. I could tell you what to do. I just can't do it. Can't or won't do it. Don't know which of those two, but it's old. It's real old. And I did my fifth step with him. He sent me to a psychologist. That had to do with work problems. I had a pretty successful dad. I'm never going to be as good as my old man. He said, you got work problems, money problems, success problems, and failure problems. Go talk to someone, and then come back, and we'll talk about it. So I get in this meeting. The psychologist wanted my wife involved. I thought, oh, crap. It's different when your wife's in the room. Conversation's very different. He wanted my children in the room, did not want the kids in the room. But, all right. And I'm telling this guy that my company's about to go down. I'm going to probably have to file bankruptcy and lose everything I had. I don't know. I'm busting my ass 2-3 hours a day. And and I explained to him that I'm about to lose everything I have. And he looked at my wife and he said, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? And Linda said, nope, wouldn't lose me. Asked the same question of the kids. They're pretty young, but no, wouldn't lose me. If you can't lose, you can't play. What I discovered in that process, I won't bore you with all the details of it, was fear. My fear list used to be dogs, snakes, and tall buildings. I mean, I had no insight in the fact that I was afraid of being a husband. I was afraid of being a father. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. I was swimming in fear and did not know it. Not too long after that, I was in my living room reading some non-conference approved literature, the other big book. I had had one of the worst days I'd had in AA in a long time. Went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game. I won $600. I missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years can do for you. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, it happened again. Weren't you there? I said, yeah, but it's so habitual. It's almost like I'm in a blackout. I mean, it's just kind of like Adam. And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it that way. Sounded like I wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble, and I had problems because of gambling. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife and children's love and affection without spending time with them. Bad design. And I realized I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clean my act up, and I had failed. And I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at a depth that I had not taken them before. For some reason, the idea of failure at that moment was okay. Why was it okay? I was in a lot of pain, and I had some humility present at that moment. I got down on my knees, I took the sixth and the seventh step, and four of the major problems of my life disappeared that night, such as the power of the sixth and the seventh step, and such as the power of the program. I am the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. We think change happens by muscle. I think we prepare ourselves spiritually in some sort of way, and the damn problem falls away, disappears, stops existing. When Bill talks about just before step 10, when it talks about the problem no longer exists for us, problem's been removed. Doesn't talk about we've solved it. He talks about it's been removed, as long as we maintain our spiritual condition. Doctor doesn't heal. It creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. Farmer doesn't grow. Plants a seed, creates a fertile environment, growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. Most of us who have been around a long time, I mean, are we different? Or have we just become what we've always been? The process of finding God and the process of growth is a process of coming home, not becoming something different than we have always been. It's removing the unworkability. The process of finding God is a process of removal, not addition. So many of us find this quandary that we're sober a significant period of time in AA and still have significant issues and difficulties that we have to deal with. First of all, it's the human condition. Do you know anybody who doesn't have any difficulties? But we beat ourselves up. I don't know. I don't know if you could hire someone to be as nasty and as mean to yourself as you are to yourself in the process of living life. It is just pathetic how we have developed this damaging, negative, horrible, shameful internal conversation, and we're so attracted to it, we just never seem to abandon it. We just, we are as tough on ourselves as anything could possibly be. Sandy said one of the reasons we don't want to get rid of our defects of character is we like some of them. They're actually tools. If your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I mean, we come in and with a toolbox entirely full of hammers. No screwdrivers, no saws, no wrenches. And we wonder why life doesn't work. We've adapted the hammers, We use the claw as a little screwdriver. If you take two of them together, you can use it as a wrench. But it doesn't work. We think we're entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. But they don't go away, which I think is prima facie evidence for they're not all going to go away. Some of these are just part of our personality. Some of where we leak, we're always going to leak and have to watch those areas of our lives. And I'm not giving permission in that conversation for poor and damaging behavior that hurts yourself significantly and other people. That's not the conversation I'm having. I'm just saying human is as good as it gets. But human is magnificent. Much bigger, much better, much. We are made in the image and likeness of God. Sounds like we're ready to have our defects of character removed. But if you're working with someone, pretend I'm working with a 35, 40-year-old guy who's married with kids and got, he's having trouble struggling with Sandy talked about with the big book, the form, the columns, it just doesn't get it. So I say, don't worry about it. It's complicated, I understand. Look, just get your wife, get your ex-wife, two of your kids, your boss, a couple of neighbors, brother, sister, and two guys from the group and bring them over to the house. And this is what I want you to say. Just say, we have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. And I wondered if you'd help. And then pass out tablets and paper and then leave. You'd have a pretty good start. But almost none of us would call that meeting. You know why? We don't want to change. But it's a little deeper than that. We don't want to know. We train each other about what you can say to us and what you can't say to us. We train our children about what they can say and can't say. We train our spouses about what they can say and can't say. We train our bosses about what they can say and can't say. We train our sponsors. Your sponsors know if you're in the game, if you got any business, or if you're just complaining. Look at your wife. Say, we're not having that. Want to have that conversation? It's going to be a tough conversation. Come ahead if you're ready. My first 7 years in AA, I tried to change and failed. I tried to change and failed, but I still grew. There comes a time where you either start to change or you stop growing. Now, that came late for me. And that's the point of my second major spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at that crossroad. Get in the game, Tiger, get in it all the way, or get out. And I was given the grace to take the sixth and the seventh step at a depth that I had not taken them before. When I took the step that night, got down on my knees and took the sixth and the seventh step, I stopped gambling that night. Now, I had to put structure. I've made a lot of promises that I've not been able to fulfill. And I knew I was in danger of maybe not being able to do some of the things that God was now pushing in front of my face. So I put a structure in. I gave my wife the checkbook. And I went on an allowance. My wife doesn't have the issues and big shotism with money, and she had us out of financial difficulty in about 9 months. I started dating my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for 30 years. I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's I was after. We found ourselves out talking about kids and bills, which is not how we fell in love. And I had to learn how to go back and get romantic and go to Chicago and shack up for the weekend and start doing. We'd get dressed up. We'd go out on a date, and no one would go out with us. It was our night. And when I was out giving an AA talk, saving the world, I'd go out Thursday night or Sunday night. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better father. I think having children is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. I think it's a great opportunity, but it takes 125% of whatever you have, and the manual is a little skinny. I made appointments with my sponsor about when I'd go to work, what I'd try to do at work, and when I'd leave. And my life took off like it was on a rocket ship. And there's a dichotomy. There's a very strong conversation in Alcoholics Anonymous about doing the work. And I think it's both. I think it is doing the work, but I think it's also preparing yourself for the gift. Bill, in the seventh step, humility is, I've had two significant problems with humility, maybe more, but one of them is when I have a problem, I don't think I should have it. why am I different? I mean, why is, you know, I mean, I think sometimes I think I'm a victim. You know, why am I different? I mean, look around the world. Is there anybody that you know that's exempt? Why are you exempt, Tiger? You know, so I have this arrogance that I, you know, shouldn't be having some of the difficulties that I have in my life. And secondly, what stops me? What I want. You know, I want the damn thing solved. And I have a very specific way I want it solved. I want it solved with money, not with a change of attitude. You know, and, you know, so I'm going to solve it with circumstances. I'm going to solve it in the world. So I'm trying to solve it at the level of the problem, not the level of the solution. And it isn't when Bill talks about pain being the touchstone of growth, it isn't until usually that I have a level of pain that I'm willing to submit myself to something, some criteria other than what I want, the avoidance of pain and the running towards pleasure. I spent my life doing that. Never has there been enough when Bill talks about it. And I think the steps are not mechanical. If they were mechanical, all we'd have to do every time we had a significant problem is say the third step prayer and click our heels and we'd be back in Kansas. Sometimes you say the prayer and no one's home. Okay? Now, doing the steps mechanically are better than not doing the steps. And sometimes in the process of doing the steps, we start to have an alteration of attitude and spirit that gets us more in the game. But there's a lot of times when we're going through the steps that it is mechanical. But because it's a spiritual process, because it's of God, first of all, words can't contain it. It is what Sandy talked about. It is a treasure map. It is a process that it takes you through. And as you go through that process, you are altered. And what alters? Your heart alters. Your spirit becomes more present. You start to see things in a way that you have not seen them before. And when you start to see things different, when Chuck talked about a new pair of glasses, when you look at the world with a new pair of glasses, we're talking about that yesterday morning at the meeting. I mean, we are people who are damaged and hurt, and we come in and we talk about how no one likes us, and we just, you know, we go sit on the bus and we sit down in the seat and everybody moves away and they don't want to talk to us, and we forget that we haven't bathed in 2 years, that we have Tourette's and we have an AK-47 in our lap, and we're, you know, and no one at the meeting wants to kind of bring this up because we're pissed off, and little by slowly we start to gently have the conversation with the person about leaving the AK-47 at home and bathing and getting rid of some of the symptoms of some of the more serious things that are going on. Most of us have had the issues of our lives so long that we identify them with who we are. And to give them up is almost like dying. Scott Peck wrote a book, The Road Less Traveled, later wrote another book called Further Along a Road Less Traveled. In that book, there's a chapter on death and dying called The Road to Omaha. And in that chapter, he talks about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of death and dying: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And, you know, denial is maybe I don't have the cancer. Anger is why the heck is this happening to me? Bargaining is, God, please remove this and I'll dedicate myself to you. And then depression, which is talking about the depression appropriate to that circumstance in life. And then he says an interesting thing. He says, but if you allow depression to do its work, which is my experience, is to grind the ego to dust. You go through depression into acceptance. Now he said, when most people talk about the stages of death and dying, they think that everybody who dies goes through those. They don't. They go through denial, anger, and bargaining. But when they get to the depression, the pain is too great, and they back off and keep circling between denial, anger, and bargaining. And then he said, interesting enough, that's the process most of us go through with significant problems in our lives. Some of that pain is what Bill talks about, pain being the touchstone of growth. It is the thing that brings humility to bear. It is the thing that reduces our separateness, and it is the thing that reduces our ego so that we can be in the presence. The most holy moments in our life are when we are not there. And in that moment, there's a clearing. And in that clearing, we are no longer run only by what we want. I am a wanting machine. I have been all my life. It is just pitiful how much that runs my life. But it is present and it is strong. And that is one of the things that I have had to deal with throughout my entire life. You only have two choices, you know. And Chuck, when Sandy talked about that diagram, the circle with the dot outside, and we're the dot, we're outside the universe, we're outside God, we're separate. It's an illusion. And Chuck says there's only one problem which contains all problems, the sense of separateness, the ego, the divider. There's only one answer that contains all answers, connection with God. And that's the only choice we have. Now, we don't always identify it. We aren't able always to word it in the way that I just said it. And I don't even know if the way I just said it is the right way for you to word it. But at any moment in time, you only have those two choices. You either address it at the level of the problem, at the level of separateness, with your intellect and with your ego, with your antagonism, with your difference, or you ground yourself spiritually. And when you ground yourself spiritually, it's an entirely different paradigm. It's an entirely different world. Nothing looks the same. You have a new pair of glasses. What you want is no longer the dominant theme. The fact that when Bill talks about, you know, that character building takes a back seat to comfort, that most of us don't want, you know, we want some of it, but we don't want all of it. We're scared to death that if we really turned our will and our lives over, most of the God that we walked in here with is a very, very old idea, which is one of the reasons that we're blessed that we talk about spirituality and not religion. We're trying to say, redesign your God, change that conversation, open that conversation up. And in that space, it happens automatically. There is not so much, it is not about doing, it is an alteration in being. Once you have an alteration in being, what you do automatically alters. When you start to change what you do, what you have automatically alters. But the direction of the water is from being to doing to having. We want to have and then do and then be. That is what the world is telling you. Do this, you'll get this, and you'll be okay. And the spirituality is saying, ground yourself in God, and everything else will take care of itself. So unless you somewhat enter into that space, either in conversation with your sponsor or in the work that you're doing with the step, where you can open yourself up and not have the fear that all of us, realize that we're talking about defects of character and behaviors that we have had for decades. Are we kidding ourselves that we just, say a little prayer and we're entirely ready to have God remove the defect of character, ask Him and they go away? Some of them do. I asked God to remove my gambling problem that night on my knees, and for whatever reason, the grace that I was offered, I stopped gambling that night 6 years ago, or however heck long ago it was. That night, 4 of the major issues of my life, maybe the gambling was the only one that entirely went away. I've had to manage anger. I've had to manage my finances. I've had to manage my attitude. I tend to leak in certain areas of my life. But they no longer dominate my life. They no longer do the level of damage to the people around me that they used to do. I'm not defending them, and I am more, I think most people would come and take a look at my life and say they're resolved. But they aren't. When Sandy talked about what happens to you as you start to grow spiritually, there's this divine dissatisfaction. I want more. It's like playing golf. I mean, you can start out as with 120 score, and all of a sudden when you break 100 for the first time, it's really a heck of an improvement from where you were at 120. But if you really love golf, you want to break 90. And when you get to 90, you'd like to break 80 just once. And so you're practicing. You're doing different things. The people you hang out with are different. You're trying to get tips. You're watching the Golf Channel. And that's what you're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. As you start, if you really have your eye on spiritual growth, you want to sit down and have conversations with people who are in that game and in that process. And that's the conversation that starts to control your life rather than the internal conversation that's been going on in your head. The internal conversation that is killing you, me, us. The conversation that says you're a piece of crap and your life doesn't work. Not everybody has that conversation as loudly as some of us have that conversation, but I've had that. That's been my mantra. You're a piece of crap and your life doesn't work. That's a bad mantra. Okay? I mean, no one specifically gave that to me. Don't know how I got it. But I've had it much of my life. Today, most of the time, I am able to say thank you for sharing and let that train go through the station. I no longer have to get in the train, lock myself in the club car, and ride that son of a bitch all the way to the end. I can watch the thought go through the station, and I do not have to engage it. Most of the really negative thought patterns that are in my life today, I have a separation from. In that separation, I am a human being. I'm not a monkey on a string. I used to be a jukebox. You put a quarter in me and you push B5, we're going to play B5. Today, you put a quarter in me and you push B5, I get to choose. I never had that choice. I used to have a thought reaction. The difference is, many of us, when we have that internal dialogue going on, We think we generate our thoughts. Well, if you generate them, stop them. 60,000 a day. You think you generate them? No. You just every once in a while, one goes through that's got Velcro on it. Usually one that has to do with you. And you get attached to it and you engage with it and you paste it on your eyeball. When it is pasted on your eyeball, it's your reality. Today, I get to take that thought and hold it out here. And when it is out here, it's about the size of a quarter. Sometimes I still put it on my eyeball. But today, more than I ever have before, I have a choice. And when I exercise that choice, I have more peace in my life today. It's like being let out of jail. I can't explain to you the freedom and the peace that I am no longer addicted and attached in an unhealthy way to every thought that goes through my head. That has been the peace of God for me in that process. And in that place, I am more ready than I have ever been in my life to have God remove my defects of character. What I want is not important. And I humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings. I'm not a victim that I have these problems. And I'm watching other courageous people that I'm in meetings with resolve these issues all the time. And from time to time, it's going to be my turn in the barrel. And you're going to be watching me. I'm on the team. You're going to be watching how I'm doing. And none of us get to be just coaches. We're all player coaches. Okay? We all are in the game doing this. And once you kind of accept that, it's just a whole different way of looking at the world. When you only look at the world through circumstances, I mean, if you are not grounded at all in God, if you are not grounded at all, you have the presence of those steps available to you as you go through life, you're a victim of the circumstances that are coming down. You're living your life holding the grid up. The grid that says this is the way the world should be and this is the way I want it, and looking at the difference between the way the world is and your grid, and experiencing the pain and the anxiety and the shame and the fear of not having it be the way you need to have it be okay. And they told me there was two ways for me to find happiness. Don't like that word as much as I do peace, but happiness. One is to get what I want. And the other was to change the way I react to whatever was happening. And what has happened to me over a period of time is you've given me a place. I never knew how to do that. How the hell do I mean, isn't that just lowering my standards? No, it's not. It is the, you know, most of the stuff that we consume ourselves with during the day in our lives is meaningless. I think if you really went out in the big AA conferences and got the old timers out on the rocking chairs and sat them down and brought your little problems to them, most of them would just pat you on the knee and say, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. It's okay. And it was everything but okay, you know, before we had the conversation. Most of the stuff that we've got pasted on our eyeballs does not have to do with really what the meaning of life is and who we are and what our lives are about. We have to, at some point in time, stop laying bricks and start making a cathedral. We have to get a different and larger context for seeing what we are doing in life. We have to get in touch with the meaning of life, with the values, with the characters, with the ethics, with the... And that is one of the things we give each other in this collective conversation that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's one of the things that God livens in us as we open ourselves up to this process of the steps and the changes that happen in us. We start to get in touch with that, and that becomes the conversation that we pay attention to. And in that space, I am more willing than I've ever been to remove the things that are the barriers, and that's what the process of a spiritual growth is. The process, a spiritual journey is removing the things that are in my way. And we think when we have an issue that it's a bad deal. Most of the time it is the universe saying to us, something's not working. Why don't you change this? It doesn't work. Most of the time we say, I'd like a different message. I'd like to listen to someone else. I'd like to change this and have it be okay. Is there another conversation that I could have? But when you're in tune, when something goes clunk, like, you know, 6, 7, 8 months ago, Sandy and I did a deal, and he said this statement, which is just live with me. He said, every time you have a conflict with another person, there's only two things that are going to happen. You either owe an amend, or you need to forgive the person. I'm saying, oh, crap, that's way too simple. And I have yet in 9 months to find an exception to that. I'm working on it. But okay. But that thought, that idea is a spiritual way of looking at life, as opposed to how I would resolve an issue in my life. You know, am I willing to have God remove my defect of character at that moment, or do I want to win? Do I want to be right? Most of the circumstances in our life are the choice between being right or staying related.
All right, we got 5 minutes. First, let's tell Bob how great that was. Just 2 minutes. Before we leave step 6 and 7, I want to just really share the full implication of what's involved. When Chuck drew that picture of the circle, and then we exist out here, that is called separation, conscious separation from everything else and God. In order to work step 6 and 7, it's much more than changing the person who's out here. We resist change mightily. Unfortunately, this requires going beyond change. It involves dying. That person out there has to cease to exist. That is when you totally surrender and give up all of the United States, every state. And in the big book, it says, we're reborn. That's a wonderful sentence. We're reborn. And St. Francis said, it's by dying that one awakens to life eternal. This person who exists separate isn't real. So we want the unreal person to die, and that's us. So I'm going, that's the full implication, is that I want all of my old ideas to be smashed and start over again, and then be in touch with God's ideas. There was a topic at a meeting, I'll close with this, my friend Hal Marley used to love to tell this story, and the topic of the meeting was killing your ego. And they were going around, and, well, you got to smash it, you got to go in, you got to kill it, you got to go after it and kill it. And a new guy was sitting there listening to all this, and someone came in late, and they asked the new guy, what's the topic? He said, suicide. But it's really called rebirth. That's it. Okay, let's wrap up.
One of the great quotes I heard is, don't commit suicide in your first 5 years of sobriety. You'll be killing the wrong person.
I got one. Thank you.